on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, February 17th, 2009. Reminder that the cell phones, Blackberries, PDAs, etc., do interfere with our sound equipment in the room. So please turn those off, if you would. I appreciate it. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 205 and ask Lori to do a summary for us.
Please. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 205 specifies the type of work in a residential structure or zero-lot line dwelling that is subject to written contract. It clarifies the applicability of contract cancellation terms. It expands the warranty offer requirement to include newly constructed residential structure or the zero-lot line dwelling sold by a contractor. It adds original purchaser to the persons receiving a consumer notice form. It specifies the time for the contractor to provide the recommended maintenance schedule. It eliminates the requirement that the Construction Contractors Board make recommended maintenance schedule information available without charge, and it clarifies and revises statutory terms.
Thank you very much. And we have Craig Smith and Kathleen Dahleen. I hope I said your name correctly. Come on up. Welcome. And if you'll please state your name for the record, and I don't know if you've decided who's going first. I'll leave that up to you.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Craig Smith. I'm the Administrator of the Construction Contractors Board. I'm joined today with Kathy Dahleen, who is a policy analyst for the board. And I want to thank the committee and the chair for choosing to schedule this bill. We appreciate that. This is a small bill with a few sections in it that addresses some of the reforms that went through last session that were recommendations of the Task Force on Construction Claims. And what we plan to do for you today is to present a foundation, if you will, about some of those changes. We have a little PowerPoint for you to show the notices that construction contractors give today. And then we'll go through the nine parts of this bill, explain them in detail to your satisfaction, and answer questions that you may have. So with your permission, we'll proceed with that PowerPoint.
Thank you so much. As long as I don't have to start it, I'm Thank you.
Oh, there it is. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Dahleen. I'm the policy analyst for the Construction Contractors Board, and I'd like to just take a couple minutes of your time and go through the contract and notice requirements that currently exist for residential construction under Oregon Statutes Chapter 701. By way of background, over the last 30 years, Oregon has significantly increased the consumer protection requirements for residential contractors. There were, in particular, several new consumer protection requirements that were put into law in 2007, and by and large, they were based upon recommendations from the Task Force on Construction Claims, which was enacted in House Bill 2654. And just to give you a bit of an overview before going through the individual documents, a homeowner having a new home constructed for them, what we sometimes call custom construction, can expect to receive up to nine different documents that are required under law, in addition to anything that they might be given that's not required. There would be a written contract with required terms that was imposed in 2007. And we have also put together a contract addendum so that the written contract the contractor uses doesn't have all the terms that could be attached to the contractor's contract. There will be an offer of warranty, a consumer protection notice, an information notice to owner about construction liens, a notice of procedure, a notice regarding moisture intrusion and water damage with maintenance schedule, a notice of a right to a lien from subcontractors, and a notice of the buyer's right to cancel if, and that's probably not quite a new home construction, but if this was, for example, a remodel type work, so that could fall into that category too. And I'll talk about each of these a little bit independently, so I'm just kind of giving you hopefully an overview right now. A homeowner that's buying a new home from a contractor that was built on speculation, what's sometimes called a spec home, can expect to receive up to seven different documents. There would be the sales contract, an information notice to owner about construction liens, the notice about moisture intrusion and water damage with the maintenance schedule. Again, it may be not quite in this case, but there could be a buyer's right to cancel notice, a notice of compliance with the Home Buyer Protection Act, and a waiver of the Home Buyer Protection Act. Those last two are unique to this type of construction. The written contract requires that all residential contracts, construction contracts for $2,000 or more in total, in aggregate, must be in writing. And there are certain terms that those contracts must contain. They must contain a statement that the contractor is licensed by the board, the contractor's name, license number, address, and phone number. The contract has to have an acknowledgement of a written offer of the warranty and whether or not the customer accepts or rejects that warranty. There has to be a summary of certain of the otherwise required notices that also have to be folded into the contract. For example, the construction lien notice, the consumer protection notice, the notice of procedure, and the water and moisture damage and maintenance schedule, even though those are all separate other notices. There has to be an acknowledgement of a receipt of the maintenance information, and there has to be an explanation of the property owner's rights under the contract, including an ability to file a claim with the CCB, and the existence of any mediation or arbitration provision in the contract. CCB has prepared a sample contract that's available to look at on its website, and we've included a copy in your packet. And what I've done here is just simply take what looks to be our sample contract and sort of fill in the blanks so you can see what it might look like. So this is how the contract needs to work, that part of it. The top of the page, ABC Construction LLC, would be the required name of the contractor. The first item would indicate that the contractor is licensed by the board and their license number. And the second item would be the address, the phone number, and that information. On the next page would be additional items, including an acknowledgement of the written order, offer of warranty. The homeowner has to acknowledge that they received the offer, and the contract needs to show they either declined it or accepted it. I've used a sample here of a deck rather than a new home. The new home is where it's actually required. Then there's a summary of the required consumer notices. Even though you get these notices separately, they have to be put and summarized in the contract. And that's the consumer protection notice, the information notice to the owner about construction liens, and the notice of procedure. And we've taken sort of a belt and suspenders approach, and we've had them actually attach the forms and make them part of the contract. And then there's an acknowledgement of receipt of the maintenance information, which is a schedule, a recommended schedule for maintenance, and an explanation of the homeowner's rights. And the other way that CCB has recommended contractors might want to do this is by using an addendum that they could attach to their own contract, and this just simply puts forth those required items which you could put on the back of a contract and use it that way. And again, this is available on the website. Turning to the items themselves, that most of the ones we're talking about will be these ones that took place in 2007. One of the new items is a written offer of warranty. A contractor who contracts to construct a new home must make an offer of warranty to the property owner. Currently, this requirement doesn't apply to contractors who build on their own property and sell the house and the land, what we call the spec builders, but that's one of the items we want to take up with the committee in Senate Bill 205. And under the law, if the contractor makes an offer in custom construction before the contractor and the owner sign their contract and the owner refuses the warranty, then the contractor may withdraw the offer. There is no required form for the warranty. It has to be in writing, but it can be any variety of warranty that the contractor wishes to offer. Then there's the consumer protection notice. This notice has been around for a while, but it was amended in 2007 as well. CCB has to adopt a notice to inform property owners of actions that they should take to protect themselves in a repair, remodel, or construction project. And this form includes information about licensing standards, bond and insurance requirements, and now since 2007, it has to again mention this offer of a warranty. And this is what our form looks like. It's pretty hard to read up on this screen, but there's also a copy in your packet. And this is something we also put on the website for the contractors to make copies of. There's also an information notice to owner about construction liens. This is required under a separate section of the statutes, Chapter 87. And the form has to include methods by which an owner can avoid multiple payment for material and labor by subcontractors, the right to file a complaint with the CCB, and the right to a statement of the reasonable value of labor, materials, or equipment rental that might be the basis of a lien. And this is the document, again, that we've adopted, and it's available also on our website. And this is actually a two-page document, so it has a lot of information for the consumer. Then we get to the notice of procedure. And this is a notice that CCB is required to adopt, explaining the procedure that a homeowner must follow to alert their contractor before they file a demand for arbitration or a complaint in court. And this is CCB's notice of procedure that has to also be delivered to the homeowner. And then one of the new requirements is a notice regarding moisture intrusion and water damage with a maintenance schedule. This law requires CCB to adopt a notice that a home builder must provide to the owner or the first purchaser of a home, a notice that talks about the definition and description of moisture intrusion and water damage, an explanation of how moisture intrusion and water damage can occur, a recommended maintenance schedule, advice on how to recognize water damage, and appropriate steps to take when water damage is discovered. And this is the form that CCB has adopted and also is available on its website. It's a two-part form. The first page talks about moisture intrusion and water damage. It's informational. The second page is a recommended maintenance schedule. Then there's the Notice of Compliance with the Home Buyer Protection Act, and this is under Chapter 87. This occurs when contractors are selling new homes that they have constructed worth $50,000 or more, or remodeled homes with improvements with $50,000 or more. In that case, they have to provide a notice of how the seller has elected to protect the buyer from subcontractor or material liens. And there are six options that the contractor seller can use. They can provide title insurance, such as an ALTA policy. 25% of the sale proceeds can be placed in escrow till after the close of the sale. The contractor can post a bond or letter of credit. The contractor can get all the lien claimants to provide written waivers of lien. They can wait. The parties can wait. It's usually about 75 days until the last date on which a lien may be perfected, or the home buyer can give a waiver. And this is the notice that has to be provided to comply with that part of the law. And if the buyer decides to provide the waiver, there's also a particular form that must be used to comply with the law, and this is the buyer's waiver form. So that may also be required to be provided. Then there's the subcontractor's rights. The subcontractors have rights to liens potentially if the contractor doesn't pay them. But before they can exercise any right to lien, they have to supply a notice to the homeowner as well, and that's called a notice of a right to lien. There's a couple pages there. Then we get into the cancellation issues. There's a general law that provides for cancellation of what are called home solicitation sales. And in the case of a contractor who might be doing a repair or remodel job, selling those kind of services, this would be applicable. If the contract's entered into it other than the contractor's place of business, such as the homeowner's home, then it's considered a home solicitation sale. Persons engaged in those sales, the contractors or the sellers, have to provide two copies of a notice of the buyer's right to cancel. The buyer may fill those out and return one copy and keep the other if within 3 days they decide to cancel the contract. This is not on CCB's website, but this is a statutory form, and that's the notice of the buyer's right to cancel. And in addition to this, in 2007, the Oregon legislature created a one-day right of cancellation specifically for construction contractors. And under that law, 701.310, a homeowner who enters into a contract to construct, improve, or repair a home has 1 day in which to cancel the contract. There is no particular form that follows this right of cancellation, but it needs to be in writing. So some of the statutes we're looking at today in Senate Bill 305 are 701.305, which deals with the written contract terms and the maintenance schedule acknowledgement, 310, which is the one-day notice of cancellation, 320, which is the offer of warranty, 330, which is the consumer protection notice, and 335, which is the maintenance schedule.
Thank you very much. Do we want to take questions now, or Mr. Smith, you're going to go through the proposed changes, and then we'll do questions after that. Is that all right, committee, or do you have questions at this point? I know Senator Girard and I were on the House Consumer Protection Committee in 2007 and are quite familiar with some of these provisions. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, I think that would work best. I was going to say that Senator Girard and Bonamici, of course, had the task of working through many of these issues over on the House side, And much of the material that you'll find in Appendix C through D and E are summaries of all of that work. And there was hours and days and weeks of work that they went through. Not surprisingly, after all of that statutory change, after it came time to implement some of these requirements, we've had some questions by contractors and council representing contractors as to how the statute needs to be interpreted. And quite frankly, we see some things that ought to be corrected. And so that's what this bill does, is address some of those. If I can, therefore, I'll go through those changes. And on page 3 of the handout, I have a chart for you that depicts each change independently. There are 9 issues, and I'll just go through them independently. The first 3 have to do with the written contract requirements. These are mandatory written contract requirements for residential contractors. The first one seems to be an ambiguity in the statute as to what work is subject to the requirements of the written contract. And this is a catch by Legislative Council when we first offered the concept to him, and he suggested this language change. The second one has to do with the contract terms. There's a part here where we separate residential contractors and zero-lot line dwellings. And the term zero-lot line dwellings was left out of one of the protections on the written contract requirements that require contracts for certain structures to have summary of the consumer protection notices. We believe that what you wanted was that both residential structures, including zero-lot line dwellings, have that kind of language, and this would add zero-lot line dwellings to that requirement. The third has to do with the maintenance schedule and a requirement that is currently in statute that if contractors contract, have a section in there that acknowledges receipt by the consumer of that maintenance schedule. Although we feel strongly that the maintenance schedule is absolutely necessary, in many cases the maintenance schedule will be developed through the construction or certainly after the construction of the house. So to acknowledge receipt of the schedule before completion probably doesn't make sense. It may not be ripe. So we think that that could be eliminated out of the contract requirements, not the concept that the maintenance schedule must be delivered, but that it doesn't need to be acknowledged before the construction of the house. Number four, has to do with that one-day opportunity to change your mind or cancel the contract. It's ambiguous whether or not this is a requirement that a consumer can elect in both a custom as well as a speculative built home. We took our best stab at this. We think what you wanted and what the task force wanted was to recommend and to require that a one-day opportunity for cancellation be only offered for a spec home, custom home. An argument can be made that it should be both. As you see, I go back and forth on this. I have a dyslexia that causes me to go back and forth on this. But it ought to be very clear whether it's one, the other, or both. And we suggest that we think what you wanted was a custom. The next one has to do with the warranty offer. It requires that it would make the warranty offer requirement applicable to both new residential structures as well as zero lot lines dwellings. We believe that's something that the task force recommended. This would add spec homes to the requirement to have that warranty. We think that's there's no question about that. The next one would expand the consumer notice requirements to include the original purchaser of residential structures as well as zero-lot line dwellings. We think that also is not controversial. Item number 7 has to do with the maintenance schedule and the time for it to be delivered. Right now, the statute is silent. And we think it makes sense to go ahead and put something in there that says that that needs to be delivered at a certain time, and that time, of course, would be at the completion of the structure. Number eight is a housekeeping recommendation for terminology suggested by legislative council, changing the term specifying to describing, and changing the term first purchaser to original purchaser. Number nine has to do with the requirement for the board to make the certain information regarding the recommended maintenance schedule available to contractors without charge. And of course we do this, but that type of requirement goes back, I believe, to when we used to do things by paper. And there was really a need to produce these things by paper. And of course today we make all of these things available by our website. So arguably we could reduce the statute by taking these two lines out of the statute. You would have no practical policy effect because we would continue to offer that through the website. Those are the nine changes that are in the bill. Can we answer questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. And we really appreciate your thoroughness organization in presenting this. I wanted to ask about the difference between the one-day contract cancellation and the consumer protection notice. Is there a good policy reason why the consumer protection notice we're clarifying applies to both custom and spec homes, but you think that probably the one-day contract cancellation might have been intended to apply to only one type of homes, only to custom construction? So do you recall any discussion about that? Is there anything that you looked at in your materials that led you to that conclusion? Because it seems, and we can talk about that a bit as a committee, but it seems that if we're having the consumer protection notice for both types of homes, it would make sense in terms of consistency to have the one-day contract cancellation apply to both as well.
Yeah. Chair Bonamici, if I can, I'll let Kathy talk about that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Craig indicated, we were not entirely sure what had been the original intent, and we could not find anything from the materials that we had. I think our biggest concern about the contract cancellation, we did treat it perhaps uniquely from these other things, is not making it as broad, is when a speculative home construction contract's entered into, it's actually a sales agreement, usually with an earnest money deposit. And it seemed like creating a right of cancellation for that might potentially lead to some legal problems for people, like do you get the money back, do you not get the money back, how broad is this cancellation right? We weren't sure that the committee or the task force had ever really considered that. So with that in mind, we thought, well, maybe more likely, and you might know the answer since we weren't, you know, necessarily there through all the discussions, but maybe it was more likely that they, you know, the intent was really custom construction, since it is a brand new right that's fairly broad, fairly significant. Whereas the notices, we treated them somewhat differently. We figured in most cases, we assumed everybody wanted to have as many notices for as many people as possible.
Senator Girard, do you remember?
Oh, I remember this very well. But I have to ask this question, and it just cracks me up, because only legislative council would come up with this. But please tell me the difference between first purchaser and original purchaser.
Right.
I mean,
Madam Chair and Senator Girard, this is one of the reasons why, as a non-lawyer, I bring staff with me who are legally trained. And just as a word of explanation, Kathy spent, I won't say how many years, with the AG's office and recently retired, and we're fortunate to be able to get her here, and she may have a good answer for that.
Oh, okay.
I wish I did, actually, to be honest, give you a really good answer for that. This was Chuck Taylor's suggestion, and Chuck usually does a really fine job of drafting our legislative concepts. I think the concern was, it's hard for me to remember, to be honest, that there might be first purchasers who were in a line of people. You had the spec builder, and then maybe the house sat empty for a while, and then maybe somebody else bought it and never actually moved into it, and then maybe somebody else bought it. And so we're trying to sort out who the person is that we're really wanting this protection to run to, and what's a first purchaser. And the idea would be it's the original purchaser, that one who buys from the spec builder, not just the first person who might occupy the house because you bought from that person in between.
Okay.
That help?
I'll take it.
Okay. And with regard to the item number 9, have you had some concern? Have people been complaining that they don't have hard copies of the schedule, maintenance schedule?
Senator Bonamici,
been an issue?
The answer is we do not have any outside folks complaining that they don't have hard copies. We're concerned that we may, and we're trying to get ahead of the game, you know, and we think that it makes some sense to reduce statute where it makes where it's possible to do so. As I indicated, if it's the committee's pleasure not to move this particular section or to amend this out, it will make no difference to the way the CCB operates. We'll continue to offer it. We'll continue to offer it over the Internet as we do today. And so this is a provision of the bill that we think has an opportunity for streamlining in the statute, but we're not absolutely convinced that it needs to happen in order to make good policy.
Thank you. Any other questions, the committee? Other questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 205, and because we have a lot of information here to consider, we'll think about what we heard today, and then we'll bring that back another time. Won't move that today. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 328, and Lori, if you could do a summary for us, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a brief, short summary. Senate Bill 328 provides for the person engages in unlawful practice under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. If the person uses unlawful collection practice in their business, location, or occupation.
Thank you very much. And just to remind the committee, we had a public hearing on this bill on the 5th of February. Also, we've had a couple of things that I want to make sure the committee members have that were brought to our attention. Senator Rosenbaum. After the committee hearing, one of them is a letter dated February 10th, 2009, from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The other is I believe all the committee members have, and there's some copies in the back. The other is a letter dated February 9th, 2009, from the AARP, support of Senate Bill 328. And also, I have something that was handed to me just before committee today by Paul Cosgrove from the United Financial Lobby in opposition to Senate Bill 328. And I wanted to make sure that the committee members had those to add to their files, and we can add them to the record on this bill.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I have at least one of those, but I don't have the other two. Are we going to get those?
You will get copies of those. We have copies of the
there they are.
Of both of those. We unfortunately don't have copies of the United Financial Lobby document because it was just handed to me before committee. Maybe we can have copies made, or I can pass it along if you'd like. You may have some.
Yeah, it's
just file already, but I'll make sure that you get that.
I think that was the one I actually was interested in because as we discussed Senate Bill 328, I don't think there was any mention that it would, any testimony that this would, you know, draw in credit unions and banks, and apparently there's some concern that it does.
And I'll have the committee minister to help with that. It actually, all it does is takes anybody who has to comply with the Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act. And if there's a violation of that act, then it can be enforced through the Unfair Trade Practices Act.
Because we talked a lot about third-party debt collectors, and we really didn't talk about the implications of financial institutions being included. And maybe the committee administrator could elaborate a little bit on that, of what the rationale is, and whether there are any concerns with it having this broad coverage.
I haven't heard any of the concerns expressed to me, nor did in the study of the statute in the revision that's in 328. It simply takes the debt collection provisions and puts them under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, would be applicable to anyone who violated the Debt Collection Act and it would be applicable then if this was passed and became law, the provisions of the UTPA would then apply,
okay,
which means the enforcement provisions.
Including the financial institutions.
Well, anyone who has to comply with the unlawful debt collection
right.
practices.
If you fall under those statutory provisions, this would be applicable.
And there was testimony in the committee about that in opposition from the Oregon Collectors Association. There were two witnesses who testified in opposition.
And I just can't. I was out for a little bit of the hearing, but I don't recall hearing testimony from the credit unions and banks on this.
No, I don't know that they testified necessarily, but they have to comply with the Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act currently. Any other discussion? Okay, we are in work session, and I will entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 328 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Rosenbaum moves Senate Bill 328 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair George.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the work on both sides of the discussion as far as getting to my office and discussing with us. At this point, I'm not comfortable with the direction of this particular way it's drafted, but I appreciate the Chair's work on this, and obviously I appreciate the folks that have come by and visited me. It's been a very interesting education on the issue. So, anyway, I'll be voting no, but I appreciate the efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Any other comments? Okay, we have a roll call vote, please.
Senator Brudet?
Aye.
Senator Girard?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
No.
Aye. Senate Bill 328 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Vice Chair George?
I'd like to serve notice of a possible minority report.
So noted.
I thought he was going to ask to carry the bill.
The chair will carry the bill. Thank you.
I might violate the rules.
Although, if he'd like to. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 328. And I'm not going to open a work session on Senate Bill 386, as I've explained to the committee members. That bill will be amended, and I do not have an amendment yet. So I will close our meeting for today, and thank you all for your attention.